Yeah, can you give them a warm welcome?
I am John, and I am an alcoholic.
John.
I'd like to thank you for asking me to speak. Thank you. It's a thrill. It's a mile a minute, and it's a good thing to come through. I remember I've been to a lot of meetings, and there's at some points you get to the point you go to speaker meetings and stuff like that, and you go, man, I could do a better job than that guy, and 9 times out of 10, it doesn't really happen that way, because you get up there and see all these people staring at you, and you like freak out, and forget everything you said. I'm a scatterbrain too myself, and I'll go all over the place and stuff like that, but I've been trying this past couple of weeks to try to get things down, keep them organized and stuff like that. So we'll start from kind of where, like the beginning, and I don't really think it's anything special or anything new about how I was raised and stuff like that. I mean, my dad was in the Marine Corps for 25 years, and he was a drill instructor, and, you know, my life was pretty much a living hell, and I really don't know why, but, you know, I never saw my brother and my sister get whippings and stuff like that, but, of course, I always focused on, you know, all the times that I got whipped and stuff like that. And it must have been because I was an out-of-control child. I must have been super hyperactive and must have ADD and stuff like that, because I was in trouble all the time. And the funny thing about that is, like, I remember that my parents, my mom and dad, take me like a psychiatrist and stuff like that, and they actually put me on Ritalin back in like the early, 66, 68 when it first came out. So I was like the experimental child on Ritalin and stuff like that. And the weird thing about that is I can look back at that and I realize that I actually abused that stuff as like a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old. Because I would dip into the stash, stay up all night, and read the little books and stuff like that. And it wasn't until about like the 10th time when I got caught, and I said, oh, jeez, we're putting a stop to this. No more of that stuff. You're abusing the stuff. I was like, hey, that's when I graduated into being an addict. And I was like, damn, that shit was good, though. And then so, let's see. And growing up, of course, my dad was a raging alcoholic, of course. Being in the military, you know, they would drink themselves silly, and that was about the way it was. But, you know, there was at one point, I don't know how it happened, but my dad finally got tired of dealing with my mom, I guess. I guess the marriage was on the rocks, and it was really weird. They did the Beaver Cleaver thing. My dad slept in a twin bed, my mom slept in a twin bed, and there was a nightstand in the middle, and, you know, there was no cohabitating and stuff like that. But my dad finally got fed up one time, and he brought me up to the dinner table and sat me down. He looked me in the eyes and looked at me. He pulled out his service 45, said, put it on the table, said, I'm going to have to kill your mother. It's like, well, you know what happened then? I just went berserk. Went over crying to the neighborhood, or over the neighbors and stuff like that, yada, yada. But, you know, you think that would have caused some... I don't blame that on my alcoholism, or putting me into an alcoholism. Maybe, I'm sure a therapist would say, that's the reason why you drink, that's the reason why you use, stuff like that. Whatever. I used and drank because I liked it, because it sent me into another world and stuff like that. And the other harsh reality, I never shared this story, and I told myself I was going to share it. There was this neighbor who lived down the way, and he was this big egg collector, had all the eggs in the world and stuff like that, and he had this butler guy, this, I hate to say it, Hispanic guy, and, you know, I was like 10 years old and stuff like that, and he lured me over to his house, and he proceeded to try to rape me, and I remember him being on top of me, on top of my back, you know, try grabbing my ass and stuff like that. Now, him saying, let me have it. And thank God the phone rang. He put me away. He said, I'll be right back. Stay here. Fuck that. I was out of there. Man, if I would have told my dad that, oh, God, it would have been a mass murder scene. But, you know, for some reason, I buried it. And that, you know, that probably... Of course, a therapist would say, oh, that's why you break. That's a sure example, you deserve it, and all that kind of stuff. Fuck that. I didn't really... I really look back, and I don't blame that on my alcoholism stuff. And on my... and my addictions and stuff like that. That was about, you know, pretty much the harem scarem of my... and, you know, I always heard of other kids running away... And, you know, doing stuff that they weren't supposed to do. And for the longest time, I used to lie about that. I never ran away. I never, you know, caused my parents grief and stuff like that. I look back, I did that. I was a little runaway. Pissed my dad off, and of course, I get whipping for that. And then it was like, finally, the last bit about this harrowing childhood is that, you know, the day that my last whipping, I remembered it clearly, he started getting tired, and I looked at him, are you done yet? You know, and I was done with the crying, done with stuff like that. And I guess, looking back, I think that's where he thought in his eyes that I grew up when I was a man, because I could take it and wouldn't cry about it. And that was the end of those whippings and stuff like that, which was cool. But so that's the gist of, you know, my, you know, unfortunately or fortunately, you know, I really hated my dad. I could care less when he died and stuff like that. That's about that. I just resented my dad completely. But I don't blame him for my drinking. I guess I could if I wanted to, but... So anyway, then I started to grow up. My friend at the time, he was a full-blown alcoholic. And this was like 14 years old. And... To clarify things, I don't remember what my first drink was. Don't really care. But he taught me how to steal pints of vodka from the store. Because I couldn't drink a pint, but he could drink a pint and a half in 2 days. And, you know, a little 14-year-old and stuff like that. He was a big guy and stuff like that. But I really didn't... I couldn't drink like him, but I was always around him because, you know, he's my friend and all that good stuff. And eventually his alcoholism almost took out my life because we were drinking really hard one night and he decided to go for a ride. And at the last minute I bailed on that and he crashed his car and just destroyed his life and a couple other people's lives because of his drinking. And that was scary, you know. Because I was like minutes away from doing the same thing, being in the same car, and there would have been a whole bunch of people. Then my body would have been involved, and who knows what would have happened. But, you know, of course, I was there with him through the hospital and through his recovery and stuff like that. And, of course, I snuck in bottles for him in the hospital and snuck in bongs to help. Because it was just... Because that's just the way we did. Anyway. So, of course, we a lot of us have stories about rehabs, and I'm, of course, the one that have been to two rehabs, and my first little rehab, because my drinking was out of control. Oh, no, that's right. After my bout with my dad and the awful scenarios that went down, they took me into Alateen, and I had no clue while I was going into Alateen, but there was all talk about, you know, alcohol and stuff like that, and I really didn't get it. I didn't know why, so it kind of didn't faze me at that time. But I look back, and if I would have probably got the message then, it would have probably been really good at the time. But of course I didn't, you know, I had more important things to do. But okay, my first rehab is, I was with this, I was with this girl. She was 10 years older than me. She didn't drink whatsoever. And she was helping me try to raise my kids and stuff like that. And my drinking was starting to get out of control. So she wanted to be like me. So she started drinking with me. And this was a person that never touched any alcohol whatsoever, and she was 45. And as soon as she started touching alcohol, her addiction took off like wildfire. I mean, in 2 weeks, she was a full-blown 2 months, she was a full-blown alcoholic. And I just stood there and watched, and I couldn't believe it. And that kind of really scared the heck out of me. And that's when I first decided that I needed to go into a rehab. So during my alcoholic craze, I remember being in the hospital, and I remember the doctors and nurses being around me and looking at me and saying, you know, are you done? Are you finished? You're getting pretty close to being dead here. And I said, you know, I've been going to AA for quite a bit at this time. And I said, yes, I'm totally ready. They said, okay, take these pills. They loaded me up on Librium. Then they came back like 2 hours later, put me in a wheelchair, and started wheeling me out into the front of the hospital. And so we got through the doors, and they wheeled me out, and there's this limo in the way. So anyway, I got up out of the wheelchair, all pissed off, because I had to walk around this limo and stuff like that. And the nurse said, stop right there. You get in this limo. This is your ride to the rehab. Okay, this is cool. So I got a nice little limo ride to the rehab. So as soon as I got in the limo, I knew where the buttons were because I worked on them before. And I hit the button, and sure enough, it was a fully stocked limo. It had the vodka, the gin, scotch. It had everything. And what's the good alcoholic do? I started drinking. And it took 2.5 hours to get me to where I was supposed to go. I drank half the tequila, a quarter of the scotch, a quarter of the vodka. And by the time I got there, I was ripped out of my gourd. They opened that door, and I fell out, and they were just in shock. It's like, what happened here? I'm an alcoholic. I drink. So that was the beginning of my first rehab. And while I was in the rehab, to insult to injury, is I ran into Cinderella. This was the real Cinderella from Disneyland, because I was in Ventura in the rehab, and she was a heroin addict trying to kick heroin. And what does a good alcoholic do in rehab? We fall in love. And I was just in love with the Cinderella, and I chased her for months and months and months. And, you know, I even brought her down. Before she got out of rehab, I brought her down this diamond ring. And it was a pretty hefty one and stuff like that. But then through about 3-4 months later, I started drinking again. And that's when she cut off contact with me. I was like, oh, darn. Plus her dad built roller coasters. I was like, man, that would have been a great sugar mama. So then after that, I got fairly clean, and I was working as a my profession of choice is an auto mechanic. I work on cars really well. I used to work on cars fully blasted out of my mind. My bosses were totally okay with it because I could get them, tear them apart, put them back together, and they'd run right. So they had no problem with me drinking on the job. I blame them for my alcoholism. But at one point, you know, I was working in a dental office. I was this dental administrator, and I wore all these jackets and all spiffy suits and stuff like that. And there was this Hispanic girl who I hired and worked with. She was, you know, 18, 17 years old. And I worked with her for like a year and a half, and then finally decided, you know what? I'm really a lean, fit, fight machine, and in really in good shape. So what did I do? I married her. You know, I was 36, and she was 18, and that was a great marriage, as far as I was concerned. Everybody told me she was using me to get her citizenship, and you know, I totally said, no, that can't be it. She's in love with me and stuff like that. But after the 7 years was up, she She divorced me, or I threatened to divorce her. She got her citizenship, and I gave her my job, the one that I was working at, and she went on her merry way and all that good stuff. Anyway, so where my little adventures and stuff like that, I learned about alcoholism. I learned about the Big Book. I came into the program with both feet in Paso Robles. They had this place called the Hospitality House. You had to walk up these two flights of stairs up into this AA room, and it's the hardest journey you could possibly imagine, going up these steps, knowing that you're going to confess that you're an alcoholic, and this is your only... It's the only thing that you've got to get everybody off your back. And once I got through those doors, it was amazing. Granted, I did not get alcoholics right off the bat. It took me years and years of in and out. I'm a habitual recoverist. I kept going in and out all the time. My first year and a half, I had a really hard time getting 30 days together. Couldn't do it. But like the program says, keep coming back. Don't leave before the miracle happens. I totally believe in that. That was the one thing that fueled me, is there's the promise of a miracle will happen and you won't need to drink and use anymore. And I latched onto that with both hands. And then the other part is all you have to do is have a desire to quit. That was the other in the traditions. All you need is a desire to quit. I had lots of desire, but it just wasn't there at that moment. So I've been in and out for what, maybe like 10, 15 years, and did countless stupid things and destroyed. I must have thrown my entire life away 3 times. And then I'd build it all back up and start over. Until one day I was living in this great motel down in Morro Bay, right across from the beach. I had it made. Had maid service, had a job with really good insurance, and no worries. Didn't have to take care of anything, no bills, no nothing like that. And then one day my mom and my 3 kids come down and knock on the door. Say, okay, you got to stop. It's time for you to grow up and take charge. So they put me in the car and they took me. The next place I woke up was in my psychiatrist's office. And I remember waking up, being in his office, and him looking at me going, are you done? And that's when I said, yes, I am. So he handed me 3 phone numbers, said, you know what you got to do. You got to make a phone call on your own, make the appointment. Wherever you make an appointment, we'll get you there. So I got home. I made my 3 phone calls, one to Florida, one to Tarzana, and one to Colorado. And Florida called me up, says, no, we don't trust your insurance company. We don't think they're going to pay. And Tarzana called me up, said, be here in 2 days. We got a room for you. So 2 days later, high as a kite on Librium, I went down to Tarzana. It was 102 degrees in Encino, Tarzana, California, and I was in the day room, no, in the bunk room, and everybody was gone, and that's when I looked up. I said, God, what have I done? I need help. I need absolute help. I got there with 2 suitcases. They took those away from me and put everything in 1 trash bag and said, here, this is what you can keep. This is where you start. I said, okay, that's fine. And I can look back now and remember that point in my life was when the desire was taken away from me. The gift from God to remove the desire to drink was gone. And I still had 1.5 years to go before I found that out, constantly looking over my shoulder, constantly trying to think, when's that monkey going to jump off my back in front of me, and I'm going to pick up and start drinking again? It's a part of the growth that we have to go through. They say, you know, God grant me the serenity for 5 minutes. Grant me the serenity for 10 minutes. Grant me serenity for a half an hour. Maybe an hour, 2 hours, 5 hours. The first 3 weeks was a constant a prayer of serenity. Serenity, serenity, serenity. And at that place, this is where I did my first 12-step. Every week I did a step one. Now every 3 days I did a step. Step one, step two, step three, step four, step five, and six. And I did a complete thorough. I had lots of time on my hands, so I did like pages of one, two, three, and four and five steps. And that was the complete immersion. I also learned what alcohol does to our body, how it fucks with our mind. Once you get the first 30 days under your belt, your body is like, okay, we're off the alcohol, we're off the drugs, everything's cool. But your mind comes back and says, fucks with you and says, hey, we thought you were just kidding. Come on, pick up, we need some juice, we need some drugs, we need to get going, we need to get back into this high life. And that beast right there is horrible. Because that's the one you got to constantly do battle with. It's an outright amazing thing that when the desire goes, the new life comes into play. It's waking up stone cold sober. It's doing things you never thought possible. Doing anything you want to do, getting it done, and being sober about it, and feeling good about it. That is the most amazing thing. And the one thing that I learned in this program, it's all about change. I'm a creature of change. I love changing things in my life. I don't stay any one way for 6 months. Every 3 to 6 months, I change something in my life. I change my hair, I'll cut my hair. Change that every 6 months, I'll cut my hair and say, hey, that's changed. One of my drastic changes was, okay, in meetings, I do meetings. I do meetings every single day. I have no problem with going to a meeting every single day because, you know what, I drank every day. I drank a lot every day. So taking 2 hours out of my life to go to a meeting is okay by me, because it's just something that I need to do, because if I get too much free time on my hand, I'll start thinking about drinking and stuff like that. So what I decided to do is I started getting bored with meetings. And so I had to figure out something. So, you know, I'll start journaling in meetings. So I sit there during a meeting. I got my book. I got quite a few books now. And the only way I can focus on people and what they say is by writing it down. Because if I don't, I'll fall asleep. And I hate hitting my head on the table when everybody's watching. It sucks. But, you know, nobody's ever asked me what I write in these books or anything like that, and I got the answer. When somebody talks about something, I write down something that was about alcoholism and was something they said that was really cool. It's like some person named Kelly said, you know, today I have more faith than before. I thought that was pretty cool. She's talking about alcoholism. That was right on. Let's see, over time we accept what we learn. And that's about AA, you know, sitting through meetings and hearing it over and over and over again. It finally sinks in, because we don't get things right away. If we got things right away and got the program instantly, AA would be done. But we have to sit there in the meeting and hear it over and over and over again, at least I do. So there's so no one person is greater than the whole. You know, that's fantastic stuff. And working towards action with others, it's all about AA. I love listening to people, because if I don't write things down and if I don't listen hardly, I won't get it. I won't remember anything. And that's just the nature of my brain. It just works a little bit different because I have just so many holes in my brains from alcohol and drugs. I have to fill it up with something. So how about a little bit of literature and cool sayings and stuff like that. And the other one is we have to accept what we've done. Acceptance is the key. So we were in a relationship and we drank it into the ground. It's okay to accept that. It's what we did. You don't have to be a dick about it. You can be nice about it, tell the person that we hurt. You can make an amends to them and say, I'm sorry. That's a part of accepting as far as I can tell. The other parts of this program is, the step one was so easy for me. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. I was so powerless over alcohol. It was unmanageable, unimaginable how powerless I was. And when I saw that thing for the first time, it was like, dude, that's me. That's what happened. I'm totally powerless over drugs and alcohol. The one thing that now that the program has eased up a lot, back when I was first began, it was very alcohol, alcohol, alcohol. Don't bring drugs in it. Don't bring drugs in it. Be quiet about drugs. But now at times, it's like mentioning drugs is okay. because we were powerless over it. And the one thing that I heard is, like, at the bottom of a bottle is another sack. When I start drinking, my wallet comes open, and if anybody's got anything, I'll buy it, give me more. And cash starts flowing out until I'm broke. Then the next morning, you wake up, and it's just like, oh, my God, where'd all my money go? Somebody stole my money. I threw it away. Had too much of a good time. The other one, came to believe the power greater than itself. Okay. That is kind of a hard one. How can you trust something in your life to something you can't see, touch, feel, or taste? That is pretty scary. It's a power greater than me. But a lot of things are a power greater than me. I've heard of people, going to the ocean, standing in front of a wave and trying to stop the wave and getting knocked over. That's a power greater than him. Hey, that's a great way to start. The book has got a lot of connotations about religion, prayers, parables, and stuff like that. We try to tell you it's a sneaky way. Don't worry about God. You'll find it on your own. And don't worry about the God thing. Focus on a power greater than yourself. Cool. I did that. I went on this spiritual quest. I read everything about every single religion and tore them apart backwards and forwards. And they all come down to one thing. As long as you believe in one power that's greater than all, it's okay. The reason why the Muslims get so pissed off of this is we call Jesus Christ Son of God. That really pisses them off. That's where they go crazy. Step three, made it to decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. How do you do that? How do I turn my life over to God? I'm going to walk up to a cliff, and if I keep walking, God's going to save me. No, that's not how it works. It's learning how to listen to God, as far as my theme goes. Clearing your mind. When we're on drugs and alcohol, our minds are racing at bad shit out of control. It's just going 100 miles a minute. When you start getting deeper into the program, you figure out how to calm your mind, how to turn things off. And when your brain finally gets so quiet you learn how to get your brain quiet, to turn off all the voices. And when everything comes totally quiet and serene, that's when you listen for God. That's when God will say, hey, go this way. Go this way. He's not going to talk or anything like that, but you'll come up with inspirations of like, I think I'll go down this path. I think I'll go down this path instead of having three voices in your head saying, okay, let's do this because it's going to be profitable to us. Let's do this because he says, so he says, she say, they say, go this way. When you have to learn how to clear your mind and just, okay, I'm going to do it this way because that's the way I think God should send me. That's a real tricky one because your brain will always tell you different. I then made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. That is where a sponsor comes in. I took sponsors as hostages. Lots of them. My first year and a half, I probably had 20 sponsors. Because they just weren't doing anything for me. They wouldn't get on the into the book with me. They just say, okay, call me for every day for a month, and then we'll start to do something. No, I want to be in the book. So I found the sponsors that would do in the book. I'd pick one sponsor for step one and get tired of him, then do another sponsor for step two. And I've had sponsors die on me, go out, drop me, and who knows why, because I guess I was too much of a flake. But back to the God thing, I'm the first one to confess that I'm an alien conspiracy theorist. You know, that they could be grays, there could be all kinds of different aliens out there and stuff like that. But my core belief is in God. The God that was on this earth, the God that did everything cool, is the one that I go to. Because all I get to do is I clear my head. And every time my head's clear, I thank God. So God, that was really cool. How did you take the desire to drink when I desired alcohol every minute of the day? How did you take that away from me? However you did it, that was cool. Love you. Thank you. I say that at least maybe 2-3 times a day because my head used to run batshit crazy. And I know there's a lot of people out there that do it. I'm not the only one. Jim said at this one meeting, a power greater than ourselves. He's always in my book. I wonder why. I don't know what I'm going to do with this book, but I can always look back and think back to myself, hey, that was a great meeting. It's a book that has nothing but positive things in it. And I could see where somebody could take a book like this and think, oh God, that guy was a freak that day. He was talking about out there in left field and it freaked me out. But if you ever see me writing in the book, if you said something cool, it's in here. Other than that, let's see. Let's jump down to step 8. Maybe list all persons we have harmed and will we make amends to them all. My first go-around with that list, I had a big, huge list. I made amends to everybody. There are some amends that you can't do because they're just too dangerous. It would hurt them too deeply. Because I asked the sponsor, do you think I should do this? He said, no, that's too much hurt. There's no reason to tell somebody that you're sorry for something like that happened, and it'd be too dangerous. But that's where your sponsor comes in. You need to bounce these things off your sponsor. They will let you know if it's good, bad, or indifferent to tell somebody you're sorry. Don't start making amends until you've done 1-7. People, when you first get in the first 2 steps, you want to go out there and make amends right away? Bad. Not a good thing to do, because you'll shoot your mouth off and then you hurt somebody, and that's where the thing, your sponsor comes in. The 10, continue to take personal inventory. Admitted, and when we're wrong, promptly admitted it. That's one thing. My life was so focused on lying, cheating, and stealing, because that's what we do. We're liars, cheats, and thieves. And when I get into a high-pressure situation, I will pop off with a lie in a heartbeat, just to, because it's a self-defense mechanism. And I tried to get rid of that one so many times. It just wouldn't go away. So anytime I get into a high-pressure situation, I'll pop off with a lie, but I'll go right back to that person right away and say, you know, I lied. I was pressured. It was stupid of me. It's an easy thing to do. It saves face. And you don't have to worry about what you said. You don't have to keep track of lies anymore. You don't have to be rigorously honest. You don't have to tell someone that they're really stupid about this one thing and you shouldn't do it. Like, let them learn it on their own. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him. Him, He, She, or It. Learning how to understand the power greater than yourself is the hardest thing you could possibly imagine. It's something you get to work on. You get to work on it the rest of your life. It gets easier. It gets better. It can fill your life with happiness and joy beyond belief. It's so amazing. And then, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and practice principles in all of our affairs. When you mature in Alcoholics Anonymous, we encourage you to go out there and help other alcoholics and drug addicts. Because the only person who can get through a person where we were at is a person who's been there. I've been to a few counselors that majored in drug and alcohol counseling who've never picked up or had a drug habit or anything like that. And I commend them for trying to understand it. They've got all the medical knowledge about it, but in order for an alcoholic or a drug addict like us to understand, it's got to come from an alcoholic or a drug addict like us. That's where the book says, hey, you have to be on their own level. If you're on the same levels with the alcoholic or and stuff like that, they'll understand it. And with that, my spiritual awakening was June 26, 2006 was when I had my spiritual awakening, and it was freaking amazing. The desire to drink and use is gone, and it's just amazing. I couldn't believe it. I get to thank God every single day. That's why I believe it's a total God thing. However you want to call your God, it's okay as long as you believe it, and that's the way it is. And thanks for listening to my ramble.
Good. All right.